Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tonight is like the night before Christmas. You have the array of offerings clustered around the tree. The sort of Buddhist tradition brings us this time of Katina festival during this month after the completion of the rains retreat. So yesterday was the full moon, the dawn today was the completion of the 3 months observance of the Vasa, the rains retreat, and this month is the Katika month. And so many monasteries throughout the Theravada world be having their ceremonies, the festivals of this nature at this time. Oh, this is a festival, a ceremony that revolves around the act of offering, of generosity. And it's one of the four main festivals that happen during the Buddhist year, and it is sort of unique in that it's not fixed to a particular date or point on the lunar calendar. And like all the other festivals, they highlight different attributes of the triple gem and the way of practice for us. The Katina festival, this time, what it's highlighting is really this act of generosity and also the quality of collaboration and communal harmony. These are the main themes that are the focus or the essence of what we're gathering around, or what we're using this particular day, this time, this weekend, as a time to remember and recollect. And people have gathered here to stay this weekend, some even coming from as far away as Thailand. Three of our friends come all the way from Thailand just to be here at this time. Actually, one, there would have been a fourth, but he couldn't get a visa, so unfortunately, the main donor from Thailand was not able to get into the US at this time, which is unfortunate, but that's the way things go. But this is what we've come to gather, to recollect, to focus on, and to reflect on, to consider, and to look at the importance of that, and to encourage ourselves to develop this quality in our life. Even though the United States might have many faults, and one could sit here and list a lot of them, but we're not allowing our good friend Yom Krit to come and visit on this occasion. He's been so helpful to us. But it has many blessings also, many, many fine qualities. And one of the fine qualities of the United States is avowed and legally protected quality of religious freedom, religious pluralism that is exhibited in this country. It's founded on the religious escapees from Britain and Europe, people who couldn't practice their own way of life, the Puritans in Britain in particular. So this modern nation was based on that search for religious freedom. And so we've been established here now. This is the 12th Rains Retreat at Abhayagiri, just completed. And It's marvelous, you know, wonderful that we can just totally free to do this. That we're protected by the laws of the country to just create our own little universe, our own value system. And as long as we stay within the laws of the country, just abide by basic human ethics and legal requirements. We're totally free to do our own thing here, to act as Buddhist monastics, to even walk on arms around on a regular basis through the streets of Ukiah, and to practice our way of life. There's no oppression from the government or the authorities whatsoever to act in any way different from the way that we do. We're totally free, and the law protects us to uphold our values as Theravada monastics, functioning and living in our own way, according to our own value system, and upholding our own spiritual priorities. This is a wonderful thing. It's not every country in the world that lets you do that, by any means. If we were in many other places, we might have a lot more of a difficult time, either officially or unofficially, but the worst we get is a few insults bellowed from a passing pickup truck now and then, but this keeps us on our toes. But, generally speaking, 99% of the time, if not more, we have a great deal of respect shown to us, and a great deal of freedom is offered to us. So that's a wonderful thing, and to be appreciated and honored. So one of the aspects of religious freedom allows is it enables us to cultivate our own way of relating to the world. We're not forced into a way of acting or a way of living that goes against our spiritual values, and that's that's particularly relevant, or maybe to reflect on in this time, because of the whole role of renunciation and generosity that the monastic life, or renunciate life within Buddhist tradition, revolves around. That as monastics, we incline towards the relinquishment of control over money, over food, over basic necessities of life. That the more that one moves towards full ordination, or even just the people who are living here any one time, staying at the monastery, there's an embodiment of that, living on whatever is offered, being content with the shelter that we have, as a roof over the head for one night, the clothing that's offered to protect us from the heat and the cold, and for the sake of modesty, the food for our stomachs, just whatever is offered, whatever happens to be given and prepared, then that's what we gratefully receive. Medicines and so forth, whatever happens to show up, or what's provided, that we make ourselves content for. So we're free to live in this way, and to cultivate this quality, which is a marvelous thing. And Ajahn Tanisro coined this beautiful phrase, the economy of gifts. This is how the traditional Buddhist Sangha lives. It's an economy of gifts. We don't charge anything, we don't expect anything, we don't cajole or insist on any kind of offerings, don't even make suggested donations, are not listed anywhere. It's a totally open system, and we rely for the support of our individual lives on that economy of gifts, on the free will offerings of the good hearts of the people of this country and all over the world that come together and support this place. And that the fact that we're able to do that and that the law protects us in this country to live this way is something that we can lose sight of, but it's something that is important to acknowledge, because it is marvelous and powerful spiritual teaching and training to be able to live this way, to be able to say, I can live in this country. I have no money. I don't have a bank account. I have no savings. Neither does Ajahn Pasuna. Any of the people from Samanera, Kachana, up the line. Yanagarika's probably have a few pennies stashed away. Debbie and Jackie probably a few pennies here and there, as the ones who haven't taken the Jata Rupa Rajata precept. But all the rest of us are penniless, and we can live this way. We're allowed to live this way and protected to live this way. And so that enables us to cultivate our own particular religious value system. Even though it might not go with the kind of the great American way of life and the sort of rugged individualist and self-reliance principles, you know, you should just be able to look after yourself and not depend on anyone. We're allowed to and protected to create this life of total dependency. That's an excellent and wonderful thing. Because that, what this does, the spirit and the actuality of renunciate life, it encourages this fundamental way of relating to each other as human beings, which is a relationship of trust and openness and a faith, confidence in the basic generosity of the human heart, the basic benevolence of the human heart. And this goes completely against the stream of self-concern, doesn't it? And this is, in a way, the essence of generosity or dana, the first of the ten paramitas, is going against the me first. I've got to keep mine. What about my stash? That mentality, I've got to look out for me. I'm the one. Got to take care of me first. My things, my possessions, my reputation, my opinions, my preferences, my choices, my stuff, my comfort. It's in a way the one way of expressing the core of the Dhamma as it manifests in the world is going against that self-concern, self-centered attitude. And at the very end of his life, a very highly regarded and wise Buddhist teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, was saying that you could summarize the whole of the Dhamma teachings in three words: don't be selfish. So that contains the entire teaching: don't be selfish. So that this principle of generosity and that sense of being ready to lay aside self-concern and to give, to look out for the welfare of others, to be prepared to offer up something that we have to consider and to look to the benefiting of others. It cuts right against, it pushes against that stream of rebirth, the stream of what about me, the stream of self-centeredness. So and this is a phrase that the Buddha used quite often as a way of expressing his teaching, going against the stream of the world. Because that's the current that we're born into. Our instincts as human beings, as living creatures, push us over and over again to protecting my body, looking after my comfort, keeping my things, protecting my territory, proclaiming my opinions, defending my point of view, expressing my feelings. That's the current, that's the stream of becoming that all of us, you know, are born into. Our whole conditioning, many of our natural instincts push us towards that. And it's ordinary, it's natural enough. But it's not liberating. These are aspects of nature, but they're not liberating aspects of nature. They're lokiya dhammas. So the spirit of generosity is, in a way, that turning against the current. Like if you're standing in the flow of a river, rather than striding along with the push of the river behind you, it's turning to face the current and walking against that pressure, you know, making our way upstream against that current of self-concern. There are many kinds of generosity, and the Katina festival is of a particular special quality in the way that the Buddha described it. There's a particular teaching called the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta. It starts off with the Buddha's aunt and foster mother Mahapajapati wanting to offer the Buddha a robe, and she comes and makes this offering, and the Buddha said, it would be much better for you, Mahapajapati, if you offered it to the Sangha rather than offering it to me. And then in fine old Theravada tradition, she offers it three times, and the Buddha declines three times and says, you shouldn't offer it to me, you should offer it to the Sangha. And Ananda, in his inimitable fashion, steps in and trying to persuade the Buddha to be a bit, to lighten up a bit, be a bit more soft-hearted. Say, look, Venerable Sir, Blessed One, you're Bhagawan. When your own mother died, it was the Mahapajapati who looked after you. She nursed you, she brought you up, she took care of you as if she was your own mother. Surely you can relent and be kind enough to receive the offering that she wants to make to you, because it'll be for her welfare and happiness. And then the Buddha says, well, Ananda, it's precisely because of my concern for her welfare and happiness that I suggest that she offers it to the Sangha and not to me as a personal gift. And then he explains, and he goes through this long and intricate description of how meritorious different offerings are. And that he starts off by, I think it starts off with saying, offering something to an animal is meritorious, and offering something to a human being who's unvirtuous is better than that, and then to a virtuous human being is better, it's more meritorious than that, and then to someone who's a stream enterer, it's more meritorious than that, and someone who's a once returner, a non-returner, and then a fully enlightened being, each of those is more meritorious than the level before, through the four levels of enlightenment. And then say, not only is it meritorious to offer something to a, highly meritorious to offer something to an arahant, but to offer something to a Pacheka Buddha, a solitary Buddha, is more meritorious than that, or offering something to a fully enlightened Buddha, Samasam Buddha, a fully self-enlightened Buddha, at the head of a fourfold Sangha, is extremely meritorious and beneficial. But he said, making an offering to a Sangha, even a disreputable Sangha, even a poorly behaved Sangha, is actually far more meritorious than making a personal offering to a fully enlightened Buddha at the head of a fourfold Sangha. He said, in the future time, this is one of his sort of rare prophecies that you get in the Pali canon. He says, a future time there will be people who go about in my name, By that time, the robe will have degenerated to just being a piece of yellow cloth that they wear around their necks. In fact, these people will be known as the yellow necks. And they will shave their heads, but they will marry and have children and till the ground and go about in my name. And even in such a time when the Sangha has degenerated to living in supposed to be a monastic community, living largely as householders, still it will be more meritorious to make an offering to a Sangha, even of the yellow necks, than it is to a fully enlightened Buddha. He says it's always more meritorious to offer something to a Sangha than it is to make a personal offering. So he, in his scrupulous fashion, he drives the point home. And it's interesting and useful to reflect on that. Yeah, but, and because even if you're making something, an offering to a really incredibly accomplished and wonderful luminous being as the Buddha, still there's that, this is from me to you, and I want you to have it. So in the donor, there's this, this narrowing of the heart, narrowing of the attention to this, to an individual. But offering to the Sangha, it's like there's, a, there's an openness there. It's like, well, however the Sangha might use this, this is, there's a quality there, a tone, and a, quali- a mood of impersonality, of openness, that is of extraordinary value. It's a subtle shift, and maybe some people will find that hard to see the big difference. But it's useful to reflect on and consider, why should that be? But if we just notice what we say, what we feel like when we say, "Well, this is for you. I want you to have this." There's a generosity there, but there's a narrowing, isn't there? There's a kind of tightening. But we say, "Well, whatever, however the Sangha might use this, it's entirely up to you. You can choose how this will benefit people, and the Sangha can use it however they decide. It's up to you." Just even in saying those words, just expressing it, even just illustrating it in a Dhamma talk, the heart feels more open, more light, there's more spaciousness. And this is what the Buddha was pointing to, how powerful that is. What a difference that makes. Then he also said of all material offerings, of all material offerings that are made to the Sangha, the most meritorious of all, of all material offerings that it's possible to make to a Sangha, whether of the yellow necks who till the ground and marry and have children and such like, or to those of us who are living a celibate life and avoid tilling the ground and live as by renunciant principles as well as we can. whatever kind of Sangha, the most meritorious of all kinds of material offerings, the Buddha said, is that of the Katina robe. He said this is the most powerfully beneficial, karmically beneficial of all material offerings that is possible to make to a Sangha. That's interesting to consider. But when we think about offering or generosity, then the mind inclines towards sort of material objects and sort of me giving something either to you as an individual or to a group or to making a charitable nation to some other kind of charity or to monastic community, Sangha like this or like other monasteries. But the Buddha also talked in many other instances about different kinds of generosity, and so that that's worthy of consideration and reflection also, that it's not just the paramita of dana, it's not just that is developed around material offerings, but there are other dimensions to it as well. And so the giving of material gifts is called amisa dana. And then another of the kinds of generosity that he spoke of is that of abhaya dana. So what we can give to each other is abhaya, as in abhaya giri. Abhaya means fear, and abhaya means fearlessness. So how do you give fearlessness to somebody? How is that an offering? Well, there's different ways to consider this, but principally it's understood as being through our own virtuous action, the way that we live, keeping sila. So that living by the five precepts as a layperson, or the eight precepts as someone dwelling in the monastery or visiting the monastery, or those of us with more involved and intricate structures of training, like the 10 precepts and the other training rules of the novices, the samaneras, and then the 227 main rules of the Bhikkhu Sangha and all of the supplementary extra Sikkhapadas rules that we follow. So that is principally how we offer fearlessness to each other, is that with by keeping precepts, it means it's safe to be around here. You know, even the animals know this. Maybe it's been a little bit active today, putting up all of the awnings and hanging up the flags so that the deer have been keeping away. But often we have families of deer just wandering around, not just sort of in the forest, but right here outside the main buildings of the monastery. Because they know this is the safe side of the valley. We don't have guns in this part of Redwood Valley. That it's safe to wander around here. It's safe to be near the humans. The deer, they just look up and maybe glance closely at you, but they see you're not going to lurk, going to attack them or lurch towards them. They just take a look and carry on browsing and trot by or go about their business unafraid of the humans. So that's abhayadana. We're offering fearlessness to the animals, offering fearlessness to each other. We don't have to hide our things away. We don't have to worry about other people in the community or other people coming to visit here, walking off with our things or having to protect ourselves physically from being insulted or attacked or any of those ethical, moral concerns. It's a safe place. Also, being a celibate community, then we're safe from having to relate to each other through sexual attraction, not needing to be concerned about whether we're impressing this person or we've got to compete with that person or whether, am I really interested in this one or that one, or is that one interested in me, and how can I avoid that one being interested in me? All of the 10,000 tracks the mind can go down in terms of kind of human pairing and unpairing and comparing. What a relief to be in a place where you just don't have to relate to each other in that way. We can just be kind of blob number one, blob number two. We separate out for our sleeping places, but otherwise we can just kind of mingle and spend time together and not be concerned about relating on anything other than a sisterly and brotherly fashion. How marvelous! How spacious! We don't have to be afraid or anxious, uptight by that whole dimension. I was also in the Thai language, the word apai, which comes from abhaya, the Pali abhaya, means to forgive or forgiveness. And so that's another aspect of abhayadana, is the quality of forgiveness. So it's like a generosity of heart where somebody does something or somebody says something that is painful to us, that the way somebody has spoken to us, or that they did walk off with our things, but maybe it was accidental, or they did help themselves to the thing that was that we were using. We're endlessly capable of brushing up against each other and annoying each other and creating friction. But abhayadana is also to be ready to forgive. That's as in the Dhamma talk that Tanyaniko gave last night. He was saying that one of the things that's the Buddha pointed out as being always beneficial is forgiveness. It's always going to be helpful to say, to find that place in the heart where we cannot bear a grudge. We let go of resentment and vindictiveness, the feeling of the desire for vengeance or the feeling of injustice or righteous indignation, without being passive or completely suppressed. We can acknowledge our feelings, acknowledge that how things have been, and let go. And if something needs to be said, we can speak from a place of kindness and and selflessness, and if nothing needs to be said, we can just let things go. We can forgive. And knowing that that's the basic principle that one is living by, and that the people that we're living together with are also following. What a marvelous quality to cultivate. What a beautiful offering. And so in the scale of offerings, it's usually presented that amisa dana, or the material offerings, is at the lowest end of the scale. Then apaya dana is one notch up. Is a superior kind of offering. That offering fearlessness, offering forgiveness, offering an environment of safety, of security, of sanctuary, is a superior kind of offering. And then lastly, he said, Dhamma Dana, the offering of Dhamma, is the highest kind of offering. Sabbadanang Dhammadanang Jinati, of all kinds of generosity, of all kinds of offering, the supreme kind of offering, that which conquers all others, Jinati, is Dhamma, the offering of Dhamma. So you can think of that as in terms of the offering of Dhamma teachings, like verbal Dhamma teachings, either the spoken word or the offering of Dhamma books, you know, like people at Tor Si School in Thailand printed up thousands, I think 10,000 copies of each of the first two of Ajahn Chah's Dhamma books, the Bodhinyana and the Taste of Freedom. 10,000 copies they printed in English to be offered and sent around the world. That's which is a Dhamma Dana, is an offering of Dhamma. So we can think of offering Dhamma Dana, the giving of Dhamma, in that way as a sort of verbal representation. But it's also an internal quality too. It's not just Dhamma as the spoken word of the enlightened beings, the word of the Buddha or the word of great enlightened masters. But there's the just as offering fearlessness is something about the way that we act, the way that we relate, the way that we hold our attitudes internally, and so too, Dhamma Dana, the Dhamma that we offer, the greatest gift that we offer, is an internal thing as well, isn't it? It's not just being able to recite the Pali chanting or to be able to speak on Dhamma themes. It's also acting in accordance with Dhamma, speaking in accordance with Dhamma as the actual fundamental nature of reality. Being Dhamma and coming from that place, manifesting that quality in our words and not just in our actions, but also in the very view and attitude that is here within our hearts. Another of the frequently quoted teachings of the Buddha on generosity is called the Brahmin from Vilama, where the Buddha talks about a previous life of his own when he was a rich Brahmin in some vastly remote part of history, and he was immensely wealthy, and it starts off in the sutta by describing this huge offering that this Brahmin made. And it's like 84,000 silver pots filled with gold, and 84,000 gold pots with silver, and 84,000 pots of jewels, and thousands of kind of horses and elephants and slaves and all this kind of mountains. I mean, just it's this extraordinarily exuberant description of stuff, kind of piles and piles of valuable stuff. What would be billions and billions of dollars worth of material gifts. And in that particular teaching, he says, even though that great gift, that great offering of the Brahmin of Vilama was enormous and incalculably meritorious. Yeah, then even more meritorious than such an offering. And again, as with the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, he goes through a sort of succession of different levels. And he says more meritorious than that is to maintain the practice of loving kindness for the time that it takes to milk a cow, which is... I've never milked a cow myself, but I grew up on a farm, but we had sheep and horses and pigs. None of them needed milking. But apparently it takes about 20 minutes. So 20 minutes of sustaining the attitude of metta, practicing loving kindness for 20 minutes, is more meritorious, is more wholesome karma that derives from that, than making a material offering of that, you know, stupendous quantity of billions and billions of dollars worth of jewels and goods and land and such like. And then as he continues that theme, he says, but even more meritorious than maintaining the quality of loving kindness in being for the time that it takes to milk a cow, and sustaining the insight into impermanence for the duration of a finger snap, is even more meritorious than that. So you might think, well, hey, that's pretty good. I can save myself billions of dollars. Just think of anicca for a finger snap, and then I'm way ahead. That's great. But obviously, it's not just thinking, you know, everything is impermanent. All that arises passes away. But it's the genuine insight. It's that knowing in the heart that the that which is the insight which is noble and liberating, as the Buddha said, that which is the true change of heart, the change of a view within us that really recognizes, oh, everything that arises passes away. Everything changes. Everything is uncertain. Everything is uncertain. Sabbe dhamma anicca. So the gift of Dhamma is not just printing Dhamma books and giving Dhamma teachings and that side of it, but it's the giving of Dhamma in terms of giving it to ourselves or manifesting it ourselves, bringing that into the world, cultivating that genuine insight, seeing this opinion that is dear to me is actually impermanent. This is not a sure thing. This feeling of excitement, of enthusiasm, is changing. It's begun, it will end. This feeling of rage and frustration is an impermanent quality. This feeling of nondescript boredom, mediocrity, this too is actually just a feeling. It arises, it ceases. This pain in the body, this ailment, this sickness, this is something that has arisen. It is changing. It will cease. So this is also an aspect of Dhammadana. We're maybe giving it to ourselves, but also that which benefits ourselves, you know, benefits the world, benefits every life that our life is in contact with, every being that we're together with. Because that insight is exactly what cuts through a self-concern. It's that which cuts through the fog of delusion. Cuts through the impulses of greed and of fear, of aversion, aggression, laziness. It cuts through. It's the that sharp edge, the diamond edge that cuts through. It's that strength in the heart that enables us to go against the stream, to go against those worldly tendencies. Whenever the heart is pulled by feelings of responsibility or fear or aggression, attraction, greed. It's that in the heart which can say, this is just a feeling. This is a really compelling feeling. It's a really convincing feeling. But it is just a feeling. It arises, it ceases. It's not self. And bringing that into the world, manifesting that in our own heart, not only brings freedom within, but it makes the world a much better place for, you know, everyone that we live with, everyone that comes in contact with us. When we recognize our own unskillful impulses, unskillful habits, self-centered urges, and we know them as that, and we train the heart to let go. What a gift to the world. How beautiful that we can watch a mind state arise and recognize that's unwholesome, that's not useful to follow, let it go. But recognize that this is wholesome, this is beautiful, this is good to follow. It can cultivate the wholesome, let go of the unwholesome, without creating a self around it, without creating an identity. How marvelous, what a beautiful gift to the world. So the other aspect of what the katina embodies is also the quality of collaboration, that the fundamental openness and readiness to work with others, to lay aside our own self-concern and self-view, self-obsession, whether it's self-inflation, you know, impressed and proud and full of our own take on things, or whether it's a critical, negative self-view of, you know, of feeling inferior or unworthy or incapable or incompetent, a negative self-view, being able to recognize that for what it is, lay it aside, and to collaborate, to cooperate. As we were talking a little bit about a tea time and describing the part of the ceremony that will happen tomorrow, is that after the cloth has been given and has been received by the Sangha, then the cloth is marked up into the pattern of a robe and then cut and sewn and then dyed and then offered to a worthy member of the community. And that all has to happen before dawn of the next day. And everybody in the community lends a hand to help make that robe. So everyone takes part in the marking, the cutting, the sewing, the dyeing, and all the little intricate pieces, elements of that process. Everybody helps out of the monastic community. Everyone joins in. It's a collaborative effort. And then the robe that emerges at the end is therefore an expression of that collaboration, the joining together of all the lay community, gathering from all over, you know, this area of California and from around the world, and the people who've sent donations and sent their good wishes and offerings, and have come themselves from all over, have joined in. So there's a collaboration between the lay community and the monastic community, and then the monastic community within themselves. And sometimes the whole process goes very fluidly. All the sewing machines work perfectly, and the sangha is functioning fluidly and easily and harmoniously. And sometimes the machines do not cooperate. They seem to have very obstreperous attitudes, and one has found that one's carefully sewn the robe with all of the the patterns done back to front, so that half the robe is inside out or outside in. What has happened in the past is where you've taken this beautiful white cloth and it marked it all up and cut it perfectly and sewn it beautifully, and all the lines are dead straight and neat and parallel, everything is tidy and beautiful, and it goes into the dye pot and comes out off-white. You find that, oh, it was synthetic, it wasn't cotton after all, it won't take the dye. Oops. So there can be many obstructions, and a couple of years ago I think we finished at about 1:30 in the morning, was it? There was a great deal of hindrances, mechanical and otherwise, kind of manifested during the process of trying to put it together. So it's a collaboration of working with things if they're fluidly, if they're obstructed, if they're difficult. Learning to find that place in the heart where we can get along, where we can find space for each other's points of view, each other's foibles, each other's failings. You know, when we realize, you know, somebody who with great confidence, you know, says, "I know what I'm doing. You don't have to show me. I've got it figured out. You know, do you mind? I've done this many, many times." And brushes you off, and then makes the fatal mistake that ruins it. How do you feel about that? How do we hold that? Can we find that place in the heart that says, "Yeah, well, that's how it is sometimes. So, okay, well, where do we go from here?" Finding that place of forgiveness, offering that forgiveness, offering that sense of self-relinquishment. Finding that place in the heart where we can let go, not blame, not criticize. And the other who's just done that, not feeling sort of guilty or self-defensive or creating tension, conflict, stress in any way. So even though we do have our own little world here, maybe the life of Abhayagiri, we have our own universe that we've spun, woven into being up here over this last 11 years or so, up here in this little valley in Mendocino County, Northern California. And it can seem like it's something, it's a little, a bubble of an ancient traditional form budded off from the rest of, you know, the mainstream world. And some can see it as very self-obsessed or self-referential, self-concerned, looking inward at our own things and obsessed with our own traditions and rules and forms and thinking about how wonderful we are, totally cut off from the rest of the world and modern day attitudes and current events and so on and so forth, you know, divorced from reality, quote unquote. But isn't it the case that taking such opportunities, taking such ancient traditions and practices, and using this as a crucible to understand these qualities of the heart, understanding, seeing for ourselves the beauty of acting generously, the beauty of offering a quality of safety and sanctuary to others, the beauty of living from an insightful and kindly perspective, the beauty of being able to manifest the insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta, the beauty of being able to collaborate, learning how to let go, learning how to get along. Just the fact that a few human beings, even though we do sort of dress in an unusual fashion for the average American, you're walking about in the third millennium, the fact that we even make the effort to train the heart in these ways, and there's this, we use this way of life, these traditions, these practices, these forms, as a way of discovering these qualities, bringing them forth and cultivating them. That's a precious and wonderful thing. That's a great gift we can bring into our own lives and thereby into the lives of everyone that we touch, that we meet, the other people in our families, the people that we work with, the others that we meet as we go about the world. So that even though this is an ancient practice, this has been going on for more than 2,500 years in this very same form in many ways, You know, the full moon has just passed. We're gathering together. White cloth has been offered. We'll, you know, follow the same rituals and rules and practice as the Buddha laid it down, you know, more than 2,550 years ago. But yet its relevance is that the human heart is pretty much just the same. Greed, hatred, and delusion are just the same. Generosity, virtue, meditation are just the same. These capacities are still the same. And that we're making this an occasion to recollect the potential of our hearts and to take the chance that we have as human beings, this little spark of life, these few years that we all have, to draw forth, to bring forth, invite forth these qualities and develop them, grow them, cultivate them, for the benefit that it can bring our own lives and the benefit it can bring everyone else. And so that this is how we, or some of the ways we can reflect on this occasion, and not just to think or listen to the ideas, but to witness that for ourselves, to see that, feel that for ourselves, see how this works, and see how our life is genuinely benefited in these ways. And this, when the effort is made to go against that current of self-concern, all these different dimensions of generosity, of giving, what joy and what relief the heart feels. So putting down the burden of self-view and self-centeredness. What a relief. How delightful. What a blessing. So we have a long day ahead of us tomorrow, so I will not protract the offering any further, and just present these words for consideration. Please take whatever is useful and leave the rest aside.